Mary Shelley, Tchaikovsky, and the filmmaker Isaac Julian. Countless artists and writers throughout history have been captivated and inspired by the Arctic. But the North Pole also has a magnetic appeal for explorers and mapmakers, enticing those wanting to leave their mark at the top of the world. In this series, we speak to people who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and tell us the story behind it. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. To look at the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. Today's guest is the first Black Briton to reach the North Pole, Duane Fields. Adventurer and presenter, he's not afraid to put one foot in front of the other, no matter what the terrain. Thank you for joining us today, Duane. And what map have you brought us today?
Hi, and thank you for having me. Today, my map is, it's a clipping from a Times article that was written in 1909, which was depicting the route that Matthew Henson and Robert Peary took on their final and successful journey to the North Pole.
So it's 100 years before you went, isn't it? But I'm just curious to get a sense of what you see when you look at this map. I'm quite curious because it shows the North Pole in the top right-hand corner, and then it has Greenland in the bottom centre. But it is funny because it looks as though there's no land, because you get the shape of Greenland and Ellesmere Island, and then it's just this sort of weird series of circles that lead you to the North Pole. What does it show us?
Yeah, so it's quite a rudimentary map, but it's got all the basics that you need to get from point A to point B. It's got the land mass of Greenland. It's got the other islands, many of the islands. It doesn't actually have all the islands depicted on the map, but it has the general route that they took. And when I look at that map, what I see is I see exactly that. It's an expedition. It's rudimentary. It's room for improvement. It's room for growth. It's room to add further knowledge. And I think a map is great, but part of the value and the beauty of a map is you build up the picture as you go along as well, don't you? Much of a map is about getting you safely from A to B and what you might find. But what you tend to find when you follow a map is your own individual story. And I think that's what Matthew Henson and Robert Peary managed to achieve. And I think that's what everyone who's come after them or since them has managed to achieve as well. They've got their own experiences, their own stories to tell once they've come back from the Arctic, if they're lucky enough to go there like I was.
Let's drill down deeper into the map Duane has brought us here at What's Your Map? It's printed in black and white, entitled Map Illustrating the Route of Commander Peary, and published on Friday, September the 10th, 1909, in the Times of London. This map is easily digestible for the highly educated readership of the Times in the early 20th century. Only the final 15 latitudinal points of the world are visible, sweeping upwards from Greenland to the North Pole at 90 degrees. Along the map's stippled lines, you can follow the progress of Robert Peary's expedition. The map charts their arrival on Cape York in Greenland on the 1st of August 1908. From there, they sail to Cape Sheridan on Ellesmere Island, arriving there on the 1st of September and leaving on the 15th of February the following year. You can only imagine their bitterly cold winter in Cape Sheridan, where the average temperature throughout the year is minus 17.7 degrees Celsius. The Americans spent most of their time hunkering down on their ship, the Roosevelt. With the first sign of spring, the expedition moved north, going further than any man had before them. Plotted on the map, you can see their arduous journey through the Arctic tundra, starting on March the 11th to April the 6th, 1909, with icy winds and towering snowdrifts hindering their path. Remarkably, on the map and in the corresponding article, there's no mention of Peary's expedition companion, Matthew Henson. His navigational, dog handling, and Inuit language skills were crucial in keeping Peary and the rest of the expedition team alive. Henson, an African American from Maryland who was descended from slaves, accompanied Peary on 7 voyages to the Arctic and was reputedly the first man to reach the North Pole during their final April 1909 expedition after Peary fell behind. And yet, Henson's story remains left untold on this map, proving that what a map leaves unsaid is often more important than what it records. And you trod in Henson's footsteps in a way, and we'll talk about that. But I'm just curious again what you think when you look at the map. Are there certain particular places that you go, oh, yep, I remember that, or no, oh, that's interesting. I'm just curious, what does it sort of trigger in you around your trip to the pole?
When you look at the map and you see places like the final destination in their journey, for me it was a huge thing because I had so much doubt going into that journey. I had so many challenges trying to get from here in the UK to Resolute Bay. It's a story. It's a real picture of the final weeks and months of their lives in the Arctic. Equally, I think there's things that stand out as well. It's how little we knew of the area at the time. These men were going off into the absolute unknown. And I think the map has a lot of information that we'd expect to find on your normal Stanford map. Now you'd find so much more information, which is missing from there. It's a very basic, a very simple map. And I think there's beauty in that. And I think that's what interests me most about it. The fact that there is so little and so much to find out on the ground.
There is that weird bit, isn't there? The North Pole is in the top right-hand corner. It's just a series of circles. It's empty. But then with this point...
There's no actual outlines of what you will expect to see. It's just a representation of what... there's an island there. I'll just do a circle. There's another island over there. I'll do another slightly larger or slightly smaller circle. And it's lots of that kind of... There's no topographical information. You'd want to know what the terrain underfoot's like. You don't know, is it a steep incline or is there some kind of saddle there? Is there a way through? Is that frozen ocean? What's the conditions like? There's none of that. It's a very rudimentary map.
Let's talk about Robert Peary and Matthew Henson, because you went 101 years after that expedition by Peary and Henson. Tell me a bit about what you know about that and why Henson is so important for you.
When I first Googled North Pole, you know, that typical image, a map and a few images of animals and wildlife and the people from there. And as you click and click and click and go down the rabbit hole and start searching more and more, this man, Matthew Henson, pops up. And I thought, hold on, he doesn't fit the typical image in my head of Arctic exploration. And I dug more and more and more and more and found out that I had a lot more in common with Matthew Henson than I might first have thought. In terms of, at the time, I remember being separate from my parents. I've never had a good relationship with them. I had been homeless. I remember reading that he had been separate from his family, parents, because they died while he was quite young. He, you know, worked odd jobs. I learned that he was really good with his hands. He built the sleds that they took on this expedition. He was great at managing the dogs, even learned a local Inuit language. During the expedition, he led for the final part of the trip because Robert Peary fell ill. And because he led to the North Pole, he was technically the first person there. There's been some disputes, but I think for the most part, those have all been debunked, and it's been accepted that he was the first person there based on his diaries and Peary's diaries. It's accepted. And I often think, would this trip have also failed had Matthew Henson not been on board?
It is very depressing in many ways, isn't it? Because Robert Peary is that sort of classic, craggy, bearded, white explorer. But Henson's story is amazing. You know, his parents are sharecroppers, you know, from Maryland in the States. He experiences huge racism as a young man. And he is, incredibly capable. And the story is fascinating that he meets Peary as he's working in a menswear shop. He's outfitting Peary's voyagers, and Peary realizes that this guy really knows what he's doing. But he's always, as it were, you know, following in Peary's footsteps, according to Peary. But that's not the case, is it? I mean, Henson is really, is to some extent in charge, and gets to the pole. And Peary then basically tries to bury his achievement, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. And arguably for the better part of half a century, he does a good job of doing that. Maybe a little bit longer, actually. So the thing is, Peary recognized that Henson had these qualities from quite a young age. And he goes on to say, hey, listen, come and work for me as a deckhand, as a cabin boy. And it's while Henson is a cabin boy and working his way up that Peary recognizes all these qualities in him. I think following the successful attempt, Peary actually gets a little bit jealous, or maybe it's a little bit melancholy. He's had his heart set on the pole for years. I think this is expedition number 4. And Peary's injured. And I think that's a blow to his ego. And to send somebody else on up front, and even though it's the most capable member of the team, we have to remember this was 1909. As a black man, you couldn't vote. As a black person, you couldn't ride the bus. You were a second-class citizen if you were black or of color. So to have this person, send this person on, you are the captain, the lead of an expedition, and to now have to send a lesser man, in inverted commas, ahead to make sure you succeed, that must burn just a little bit, or you must feel it ever so slightly. And I think they become very distant after this expedition.
I was reading the correspondence of what happens that April 1909, and it's on 6th of April that Henson goes ahead and he comes back and he says, and it's a quote, he says, I think I'm the first man to sit on top of the world.
Yes.
And that, as you say, that must have just, for Peary, been infuriating. But, you know, nevertheless, you have to acknowledge that. There's another interesting moment that when Henson comes back, I was reading about, and I wondered what you thought of this. I don't know whether you've heard this, but Henson says when he comes back to the States late in 1909, he says, when I went to Greenland, they said I would never come back. They told me that I could not stand the cold and no black man could. I said I would die if necessary to show them. I survived all right and here I am. I wonder what you make of that comment, you know, the power of that.
I remember that comment and I remember it for a couple of reasons. One reason, because I heard that so many times, Jerry. I heard when I first said I was going to the pole, people said the exact same thing to me. And it was amazing because I hadn't read that quote until after I'd heard people saying, yeah, but you're black. Yeah, but you're Jamaican. Man, black people don't go to the pole. And it was later when I read that quote from Matthew and I thought, gosh, 100 years on and we're still saying the same things. And back then, I guess you could almost excuse it. It wasn't right. You could almost excuse it because of the way things were socially, the social dynamics between different races, different cultures. But nowadays, looking back and looking at the achievements of people from different ethnic groups, minority ethnic groups, and what they've done, they have proven time and time again that there is very little difference between us other than our mindsets. And that's the mindset of the individual that's attempting the task. Now, when I heard that Matthew were told, you know, you're going to die, as I sit here today, I remember people saying, yeah, you're going to lose bits and pieces. Bro, you're going to die, man. That's not for us. And that's the cold and black people aren't. And I just remember thinking, what a stupid thing to say. And if I'm honest, it did crossed my mind a few times while I was in the Arctic, especially on the days where it got extra cold. And I thought, and I wondered, are my white counterparts feeling the cold the exact same as me? And it just goes to show things that people say can impact you. It might not impact you in the moment and you might be able to rise above it. But sometimes it does play a little bit of a negative tune in the back of the mind somewhere.
Well, there is that weird thing, isn't there, that somehow it's the North Pole is white, you know, it's that strange thing.
Yeah,
that
there is.
And Peary plays on that. So Peary talks about when he claims that he's got there first, you know, he says, He actually writes, he says, I'm a Caucasian, and I'm going with this guy Henson. And he calls him an Ethiopian. I mean, it's bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, keep it simple. I think a lot of, when you read some of the things that Peary wrote, especially prior to going on this particular expedition, about in reference, because I think there's maybe two or three references where he almost belittles Henson a little bit. Mm. It's hard for him to do it completely because it's clear that he has a lot of respect for Henson's talents and capabilities. But as a man, I think there's a few times where he belittles him just a little bit or takes away from who he is and what he stands for just a little bit by calling him, by elevating himself that much more above Henson, or like you said, diminishing who Henson is by just a simple mistake. He is an African-American. He is an American. Mm. He, you know, distances himself further by calling him an Ethiopian. Mm. On the flip side, you have to give the man credit to a degree. Peary knew he needed somebody like Henson. And I don't think Peary cared what that person looked like as much as he did when Henson came back and said, hey, I think I'm the first to have stood on the pole. I think at that point, he despised him a little bit.
But the relationships are complicated, and you must have a view on that, that you're locked together with these people in these extreme environments for weeks and weeks on end.
These men were away for years and years and years at a time in some cases. When you're on the expeditions, you're together 24 hours a day. You're in a confined space. The tent where you spend much of your time that you're not walking becomes your home. It's where you laugh. It's where you, where people might give you, administer first aid. It's where you read. It's where you share stories and experiences. The closeness, and I actually think that the closeness they experienced probably before this expedition, during this expedition, would have been something they both missed when they got back home or went their separate ways, especially after Matthew wrote in his diary and Peary wrote in his books of their experience. I think they would have missed it to a degree because there's a sense of closeness that you just can't build any other way. You build it through adversity. You build it because you're both going through, or you and the team are going through something that's tough, that's unique, that's very rare, that's limited to a few people, and only a few people can ever understand it. And of those who do understand it, very few will understand it from the experience that you've just shared. So it's a very unique place to be.
How did you get into adventuring? You've said a little bit in your own backstory about how you were not somebody who might immediately be drawn to this. Why did you become so interested in this?
I think you're drawn, you're either drawn to adventure or you're pushed to adventure. And I think I was always drawn to the outdoors, not necessarily the adventure of it, but just the space, just the fact that you could learn and experience and feel free. And it felt like a very liberating and natural space for me to be in. Where I was born in Jamaica, I was born in the outdoors. I was, you know, we had fields and forests and woodlands around my house. It's the first environment that I had ever known. I knew what trees and plants I could eat before I knew, you know, buildings had two or three floors. So for me, it was always natural to want to be outside. I was pushed to adventure because as a teenager growing up and into my early 20s, I had an experience where a gun was pulled on me and, you know, the trigger was pulled twice. And I remember thinking, gosh, whatever it was that led this person to pull a gun and attempt to take my life, we can't let it continue. And I thought, how can I best steer young people, my peers, away from that life? And I thought, well, I know, I'll do something difficult, do something hard to prove to them that if me, just any regular simpleton from Stoke Newington, East London, Hackney, can do something a little bit challenging, a little bit outside the box, then actually they can do it too. Because there was nothing special about me. And I didn't know what that thing was. I didn't know what adventure, what outdoor activity, what that thing was. I couldn't decide. And then I saw Ben Fogle, and I saw James Cracknell talking on Breakfast TV one day about just rowing across the Atlantic. And they said in the next breath, we're now going to Antarctica and we'd love to invite everyone who's watching to apply to be a third team member.
So when was that? How old were you, Dwayne?
Oh, that would have been 2007, I think that was. And I would have been about 24 at the time.
Right.
And I remember thinking, gosh, do you know what? I'm going to apply. But I was terrified. I was so anxious and my confidence so low that I found all the excuses in the world as to why they wouldn't let me go. And anyway, about 3 weeks later, a month or so later, I sent off an application form and I was told, sorry, selections have started. You've missed the first stage.
Yeah.
We can't let you into the application process now. Would you consider going to the North Pole? And I thought, well, actually, I'm black. I'm from Jamaica. I grew up in London. As far as I'm concerned, they're both covered by ice. They're both cold. A pole's a pole. So yeah, why not? I was Googling the North Pole to try and just upskill myself a little bit, further my knowledge. And I came across Matthew Henson. I found out this guy was great with his hands. He was great with making things. And he was, you know, he was a young person who was estranged from his parents. I have some experience of that. And I found more and more similarities between himself and me. And it just gave me more of an impetus to make sure this happened. That's what got me on the path to the North Pole.
Tell me a bit about the day-to-day reality of going to the North Pole. I mean, this is what fascinates me. You know, I was thinking about it this morning. I got up and I thought, what happens when you're traveling to the North Pole and you get up in the morning? You don't just put the kettle on. I mean, day-to-day, Dwayne, give me a sense of, you know, I guess both the highs and the lows of what you're doing, you know, hour by hour.
So when you wake up, first of all, remember the time of year that we did it and Matthew did it would have been daylight 24 hours a day.
Mm.
Now, that has its own challenges. It's hard to sleep, especially in the first, you know, few days, week or so. It's hard to find that rhythm. Now, once you've got that rhythm and you wake up in the morning, the first thing you have to deal with is getting out of that relatively warm sleeping bag and getting into that freezing cold tent. That's challenge number one. So once you've got your mind set and you've stepped out of that sleeping bag and you've turned on your stove and you've started to boil the water to make your porridge or make your tea or your coffee or whatever else, that's the first challenge. The next challenge is getting out of that relatively warm tent and going out into minus 15, minus 20, minus 25. If the wind's blowing, it can feel as low as minus 50, like it did in our expedition.
Yeah.
So a lot of your day starts with you building yourself up and getting your mind right. Once you've got out and you've packed away the tent, it's actually quite easy going, providing the weather conditions are all right. You start walking on a bearing. You check your bearing, check your compass, check your bearings, and you start walking on that bearing. And then for the next 2-3 hours, you walk and you might stop for 5 minutes or so just to take on some fluids, take on a handful of food, which were part of our day sacks. It's a lot of walking. Oftentimes you're walking in silence. Every now and then you'll find that you think of something funny or think of something you want to share with your teammates or they do it. And you'll forget where you are and you're just out for a stroll, which happens to be in one of the most remote places on the planet.
I did wonder that. Are you talking about, you know, football or, you know, your family?
Oh,
you're
talking about everything. You're talking about absolutely everything from families. We spoke a lot about pets when we were younger. We spoke about life, where we came from. My two teammates were as close now as we'd managed to get on the trip. As we got to being on a trip. And the other thing is, sometimes you look up and it's the most beautiful sight you'll ever see. The sky takes on a range of colors stemming from greens to oranges and purples and reddish colors. And obviously, because the ice crystals in the snow on the ground are refracting and reflecting the light, it almost feels like you're in a surreal world, which, you know, you feel so fortunate to get to see, but it's hard to articulate. I don't think I can find the words to really articulate exactly what it looked like, but it was just the most beautiful thing at times. And, you know, every now and then you'd have to look over your shoulders to make sure you're not being tracked by a polar bear, which we know is the largest land predator.
Wow.
And, you know, we had that experience as well.
Yeah.
So I assume Matthew Henson and Robert Perry and their team were the same.
It is amazing, isn't it? And I want to ask you about the wonder of that, of getting there, the notion that you're on top of the world. Because, again, I was reading about Peary, and Peary at one point talks about getting to the pole, and he says, it is the point where the axis of the earth cuts its surface. It is the spot where there is no longitude, no time, no north, no east, no west, only south, the place where every wind that blows is a south wind. It is the place where there is but one night and one day in every year. and this wonder of the sense in which you are on top of the world. Is that something that you felt when you sort of finally got there and you thought, here I am?
I felt like I was doing it to encourage so many people, to inspire people to believe in doing maybe something that's not as extreme, maybe setting their goals higher than where they were, but it didn't have to be as so far-fetched as, you know, the Arctic. I wanted to also prove everyone who said it can't, I couldn't do it, wrong. I also wanted to pay homage to Henson as well. So when I arrived there, it was a lot of emotion. I looked at my teammates and I think we were all a little bit emotional to say we'd accomplished something that none of us had personally known somebody else who'd accomplished. I also felt this sense of almost anticlimax when I arrived at that spot.
As they all did. The I wanted to journey. Ask. Yeah, everybody yeah. says that. Yeah. They all say that. One of the other, Frederick Cook, who's one of Peary's great rivals, says he got there and he just said, it's just this sort of desolate space. And you get this sense of massive anticlimax as well as sort of elation. Yes.
Yeah, I experienced that for a number of reasons. One, during the journey on the hardest days, I would play an image in my head. And it's a bit silly, actually. I used to play this image in my head where I'd say things like, there's a quote from Thomas Edison that I played over and over. Most of life's failures are people who give up without realizing how close they are to success. Mm. And every time I played that in my head, I'd take a couple more steps. Yeah. And I'd play this other image where there were people throwing confetti and fireworks and all these exciting things happening when we arrived. And I remember arriving thinking, oh, gosh, there's no one with fireworks here and there's no confetti. And, you know, it was that. And I did it to kind of almost gas myself up to make me take a few more steps. And it worked during the journey. And when I arrived, I think that image in my head just melted away. And there was an empty space for a little while. And it was quiet. And I looked at that patch of snow and I thought, gosh, that looks exactly the same as a patch of snow 100 kilometers, 200, 300, 400, 500, 600 plus kilometers back. So for those reasons, there was an anticlimax. Plus we had, and this is something that Matthew and Robert didn't have. They didn't have to walk a day further to get to an extraction point. They had to make it all the way back. So that's something that they had that I will never experience or have never experienced up until this point. But for me, it was always just about proving that I could do it, proving to myself that I could do it, and proving to other people who said, one, I couldn't, and two, they didn't understand why I was doing it. Because for me, the journey was all about setting a gauntlet for every other person to say, well, actually, look, this is something that I've chosen to do. It's personally very difficult for me. I challenge you now to go and find your personal, very different, difficult thing and make that happen. I've proven I can do it for my thing. Nothing special about me. You can do it for yours. Go and get it done. And I felt a sense of relief that I'd actually done it, because I didn't want to come back and have to face all the naysayers who'd said, you can't do it, and now come back and prove them right as well.
Yeah. I mean, there is that old saying, isn't there? It's not really about the destination, it's about the journey. And from what you've been saying, there is something about that for you. I mean, I wonder, how much did it change you, Duane? I mean, that sense of achieving that, but also the journey there, and how it must have made you think about yourself and, I don't know, your relationship to the world. I mean, we haven't really talked about that, but the sense of the environment being there and the way in which the world is changing. How did it change you?
I've always been passionate about the environment. I've always been passionate about the outdoors, wildlife, nature, the ecosystems around us. I think walking to the North Pole, it gave me a soapbox that I could stand on and say, hey guys, listen, I've done this thing. This is what I've seen. This is what I've experienced. And in doing so, I developed a passion for storytelling. I remember one of the very first talks I did was to a group of young people here in London. And I remember at the very end of the talk, there was one kid at the back of the room. I think his hood or a hat was on, and he didn't seem to be paying attention. But when everyone else was walking out the room, I was still in there, he came over to me and he said, so what do you think I could do something like that? And in him saying that, I realized the power of doing an expedition like this, but sharing an expedition like this as well. Because he was one of these kids who was too, I don't know, he had the facade on, the world around him, the community he lived in, he had to put on a facade, be tough, not show that he was interested in anything, not show any weakness, in inverted commas. And the moment that he had just a fraction of a second to say, hey, listen, how would I do something like that? He seized it.
Yeah.
And that to me just said that there are a lot of young people out there waiting for an opportunity. And I felt more like it was my duty to share what I'd experienced in order to encourage them and to inspire them, if I could, to go and pursue stuff.
And you've gone on to do that quite a lot, haven't you? I mean, tell me a little bit, because you've been working with people like Ben Fogle and with Will Smith. Where has that taken you since that journey to the North Pole?
So I think I've been typecast now as the guy that likes the cold. I'm from Jamaica. I do not like the cold. I just want to put that out there now. I do not like the cold. I do it because it's a personal challenge.
Can that be your memoir?
I do not like... Is that the title of it?
I think
I'm
it
Jamaican,
should be.
I do not like the cold. Who knows? Maybe we've just dropped onto something there. Yeah. I'm going to write that down, actually.
And where next for you, Dwayne? You've been to the top of the world. So what's in store next?
So a couple of days ago, I got back from an awesome expedition across Africa. And when I say across Africa, I mean from the Indian Ocean all the way to the west, to the Atlantic. I'm headed back to Tanzania and Zambia in a couple of months. And following that, the work that I do with young people via the We Too Foundation, something that I and my teammates set up, we're taking a group of underprivileged young people from the UK on a carbon negative expedition to the Galapagos Islands.
Wow.
And that's all about doing all the things that I've just said, which is building up on that ability to share your experience with somebody else, build up a team through a shared experience, build on your personal confidence, do things that you can add to your CV, which makes you so much more employable going forward as well. So that's what we're doing with young people who would have lives similar to what myself and my teammate had.
Amazing. I want to ask you about maps finally again.
Uh-huh.
Do you take printed maps with you, or do you use online maps? And what's your relationship now to maps? I'm just curious because you are an adventurer.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I like to do is I'll download a map. So Ordnance Survey, I'm going to pick them out because I was an Ordnance Survey Get Outside champion. I use their maps from time to time. I'll download a map for an area that I'm going to, especially here in the UK. If it's further afield, I might download a map and make sure I've got a digital copy, which I use more. But I do like to have a traditional paper map. I do. I genuinely, there's something about having a map in your hand that gives you a sense of security. The battery won't die. The screen won't crack. If you know what you're looking at, it opens up a whole new world to the environment around you. It tells you what you can read. It's almost like looking into the future, because you can see what you're coming across if you're competent at reading a map. It's a great way to feel confident in where you are and where you're going, because you look for points along the map. You can handrail certain features. You can, you're looking for an outcrop of rocks. Oh, actually, there it is on a map. There it is on the land. Your confidence is up now. You know you're on the right path. And if you come across something you don't see on the map, it's like a bonus.
Amazing. You've just melted the heart of all us map historians, Dwayne. So bless you for that. Dwayne Fields, thank you very much for joining me on What's Your Map?
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to What's Your Map? I'm Jerry Broughton, map historian, and this has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases.